Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 14 hours GMT on Monday the 2nd of January, these are our main stories. A Russian official says President Putin's forces suffered a massive blow in a Ukrainian attack on hundreds of soldiers in Donetsk. A public wake has begun at Santos FC in Brazil for the legendary player Pelé. The Indian Supreme Court has upheld a decision by the government to withdraw most high-denomination notes. Also in this podcast, 14 people are left dead as suspected drug cartel gunmen help prisoners escape from a Mexican jail. Saving energy in French supermarkets.
You're always moving in a hypermarket, so that keeps you warm. As for the lights, perhaps you can't see things quite as clearly, but you can still see the prices.
On voit quand même les prix.
And the body of the late Pope Benedict is lying in state at the Vatican. On New Year's Eve, President Putin vowed to press on with what he calls his special operation in Ukraine, promising that we will triumph for our families and for Russia. At the same time, though, his troops suffered another deadly defeat in the war in Ukraine in an attack in the eastern region of Donetsk on Saturday. I heard more from our Kyiv correspondent, Hugo Bechega.
What the Ukrainians are saying is that 400 soldiers were killed, 300 wounded. They're talking about a base, a school that was being used as a base by Russian forces in the occupying town of Makiivka in the eastern Donetsk region. As usual, they don't say they were behind this attack. What we're hearing now from Russian reports, reports on Russian state media, is that HIMARS missiles, those US-supplied missiles, have been used to target this facility. And we're getting some conflicting reports in terms of numbers. We have these numbers from the Ukrainians, which obviously haven't been independently confirmed. But the Russians are saying that 15 people have been injured. So very different numbers, different accounts being given by the Russians, by the Ukrainians. But some Russian military bloggers have confirmed that this base was attacked and that hundreds of people have been killed and wounded. So complicated story, conflicting details coming from both sides. But it seems that this base that was being used by Russian forces, conscripts in this town, has been targeted by Ukrainian forces.
If the Ukrainian figure is correct, that would be a pretty significant attack, wouldn't it?
Could be talking about perhaps one of the deadliest attacks by Ukrainian forces targeting Russian positions in this war. And I think there's been a lot of anger among those Russian military bloggers, people saying that commanders should be punished because of the accommodation there in this place. And that some reports saying that 1,000 conscripts were there waiting to be deployed. So it seems that we're talking about a massive attack by Ukraine targeting Russian forces in the eastern part of the country.
And briefly, Hugo, also further Russian attacks overnight in Kyiv.
Yeah, another night in which residents were told to seek shelters. The air raid alert sounded shortly before midnight here for the second night in a row. And while the Ukrainians say that all 39 drones used in the attack were shot down by the country's air defense forces. And I think here, again, we're seeing that Kyiv was under attack. Ukrainians are angry, tired of these attacks. They say that civilians have become the target here. And obviously, again, energy facilities were damaged. Power supplies have been disrupted here. So it's not only the fear, the panic that these attacks have caused, but also the disruption, because people, sometimes millions of people across the country, are left without power, without heating, and even without water as Russia continues with this campaign targeting this country's essential infrastructure.
Hugo Bechega in Kyiv. The war in Ukraine has driven up global prices of fuel, food and fertiliser. That's especially keenly felt in much of Africa. Despite that, many countries have strong ties to Moscow, and the Russian-backed mercenary group Wagner has been operating in West African countries that have seen military coups. Our senior Africa correspondent Anne Soy considers the paradox.
Demonstrations in support of Russia would have been unimaginable just years back. But here, dozens of Malians held processions through the capital, Bamako, waving the Russian flag and chanting anti-French slogans. The country has had a difficult relationship with its former colonizer. French forces, which were helping fight growing extremism in the region, have withdrawn from Mali. So have many of their allies. We cannot exist in the same space as a group that does not stand for human rights, says America's ambassador to neighboring Ivory Coast when they asked about the withdrawal.
It is absolutely convinced that the presence of Russian mercenaries in any country is bad news. Any country that has had Wagner has become poorer and less secure rather quickly. They are not very good fighters, and they commit terrible human rights abuses, and they're just a destabilizing force.
We spoke just days before Russia invaded Ukraine. A UN vote to condemn Russia's actions divided the continent, with half of the countries voting in favor. 17 abstained, 8 did not vote at all, and 1, Eritrea, voted alongside Russia against the resolution. The US went on a charm offensive to try and win them over. A bill was also passed by the House of Representatives in April to help counter Russia's influence in Africa. But that may have alienated some further, like South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa.
For the most part, most of African countries are non-aligned. It would be unfair for the US to punish African countries by just merely either associating with Russia on an economic basis or a business basis.
President Ramaphosa had previously spoken to Vladimir Putin and offered to play the role of mediator in the conflict. The country would later initiate another vote at the UN Assembly, which flopped. The continental body which brings together all African countries, that's the African Union, has avoided taking sides. The chairperson, Senegalese President Macky Sall, called for de-escalation and visited both Russia and Ukraine to lobby for the release of grains from the port of Odessa. President Putin obliged, clearly keen to keep his ever-shrinking support going and allies on side. He signed a deal with the UN and Turkey that led to the release of some of the grain that had been held up at the port. But 10 months since he went to war, nothing much has changed in Africa. The continent remains as divided as ever on the war in Ukraine.
Our senior Africa correspondent, Anne Soy. Now to Brazil. Fireworks greeted the hearse containing the coffin of the Brazilian football legend Pelé early on Monday as it made its way from the hospital in Sao Paulo, where he died, to the place where it all began, the stadium of the club Santos, where he made his name. It's there that thousands of fans and dignitaries lined up to pay their final respects. Our correspondent James Reynolds was there to see it all.
I'm in the main stand of this really, really modest stadium, the Santos Stadium, in which Pelé, as you rightly said, made his name. He was a 15-year-old when he got here in the mid-1950s. He soon became a name known across the world. In front of me on the terrace opposite, Viva o Rei, Long Live the King, with a picture of Pelé in the black and white Santos strip being hoisted on his shoulders. Pelé, at the age of 82, number 10 shirt of Santos. And then in the last 6 minutes, we've had the first stream of mourners going past the pavilion set up exactly on the centre of the pitch. Those mourners are filing past slowly. I saw one man a few seconds ago carrying his young child. The man wiped away tears. There were others wearing the Pelé shirt. You can see the distinctive gold among some people in this stream of mourners, some carrying replica World Cups, many taking photos. I spent some time in the crowd outside, and they say they came to bear their respects to someone who made Santos known across the world. And those mourners are continuing to file by slowly underneath this pavilion set up in the centre of the pitch. There are flowers, there are police officers, there is a ceremonial band.
Many ordinary Brazilians, but also some very big names there.
We are expecting at some point the president of Brazil, the new president of Brazil, Lula. And bear in mind, at one point in the past, Pelé himself was a minister of sport in a previous Brazilian government. Also, the head of FIFA, Gianni Infantino, is expected to pay his respects. But looking at this spectacle at the moment, I should say that this is probably not about the VIPs. This is about the people whose names we don't know, who spent much of their lives here in Santos. Many of them, the ones I've spoken to, met him briefly for a few minutes or so. And as they file past, they're wearing those Brazil shirts, the shirt popularized by Pelé. One is carrying a flag and waving it at photographers, the black and white of Santos.
And what happens next?
The crowds will continue to filter past here for the next 24 hours. And then a hearse will take Pelé's coffin, a short journey, it's only 500 metres, towards the cemetery in which he will be buried. It is a semi-skyscraper of a cemetery, and we expect people to line that route for the final journey of Pelé. That will be on Tuesday.
James Reynolds. In Cambodia, the prospects for the critically endangered Mekong River Irrawaddy dolphins are bleak. There are fewer than 100 left in the wild, according to the Worldwide Fund for Nature. But there's new hope for the mammals. The government is stepping up conservation efforts after campaign groups called for full-time protection. I asked our Asia-Pacific editor, Celia Hatton, how and if the plan would work.
The Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen has announced that he will designate certain sections of the Mekong River that flows through Cambodia as being off limits to fishing. So he says they're going to be marked very, very clearly. Although conservationists, as you mentioned, Alex, are calling for round-the-clock patrols. That's because illegal fishing is a major problem in Cambodia. And that's really what's led to the death of so many Irrawaddy dolphins in recent years.
Presumably the fishermen are not happy about this.
Well, it's tricky because most dolphins are killed by illegal fishing techniques. So using things like gill nets, which are vertical fishing nets that are hung and the dolphins get trapped in them and then drown. They can't get to the surface in order to breathe. So that's the problem, really. Also, some illegal fishing techniques using explosives or even electrocuting fish, those also harm dolphins. But fisher people say, look, the issue is that the government isn't really giving them any other way to survive. They traditionally lived on fishing. Around 65 million people live in the lower Mekong Basin. That goes from Thailand all the way through Laos, Cambodia, into Vietnam. They're dependent on the river and living along the river. So simply banning fishing without giving those people any other form of making money or feeding themselves really isn't going to solve the problem.
And wildlife is also under threat, just as areas along the Mekong River industrialise.
That's right. I mean, the Mekong itself is really under threat in general, not just the dolphins who live in it. So the dams at the start of the river in China are causing many problems for those who live further downstream. Also, climate change is really affecting how the rain that replenishes the river. So river levels are changing constantly. The wildlife that depends on the river is also in crisis. And so there's a real problem right now. So it's not just for the dolphins, it's the river in general that really is in crisis.
Celia Hatton. Still to come in this podcast, our reporter in Ghana investigates reports of a man said to have broken the record as the world's tallest.
It turned out that he had outgrown the measuring skill that he had, and so they improvised. They brought together a wooden stick which they used as an extension.
They began queuing before dawn, and it wasn't long before thousands of people had gathered at the Vatican to file past the body of Benedict XVI, who died on Saturday, aged 95. He's been laid out in papal mourning robes, his eyes closed, in front of the altar of the church, flanked by two Swiss guards. A religious service was held as the body was carried into St. Peter's Basilica.
Christe, Christe,
Pope Benedict died nearly a decade after becoming the first pope in 600 years to step down from the job. His successor, Pope Francis, will preside over the funeral service. These mourners at the Vatican say they'll miss the former pontiff.
Seeing him filled me with great emotion. He was a great pope. He was a highly valued figure from a theological point of view, as well as his role in the church. His resignation affected me a lot.
Pope Benedict was a good pope in every sense. His decision to step down was a wise one at the time. It was a choice made for God, and a strong change was needed in the church.
But there was also scandal. During his papacy, the Catholic Church faced a wave of allegations about child sexual abuse by priests, and Benedict was criticised for his handling of the issue. The BBC's religion editor, Aleem Makbul, spoke to me from the Vatican.
Things have sort of ebbed and flowed. There were certainly thousands snaking in queues around St Peter's Square earlier in the day. They have dwindled a touch now, but we anticipate that later in the day more people will come. This, though, is the first of 3 days during which Benedict XVI lies in state. But it's interesting what you were mentioning there about the legacy of the Pope Emeritus, because we have been discussing over the last couple of days, of course, how in the eyes of many his reputation was tarnished because of a failure to act against perpetrators of abuse, both while he was Archbishop of Munich and then later as Pope. That wasn't the discussion being had today here in St. Peter's Square. These were the people who wanted to be first in line to see the Pope lie in state. At the very front of the queue, I spoke to priests and nuns. There was a priest at the very front of the queue. The first person to go inside was called Father Alfredo from the Philippines. He really was very emotional. He admired Pope Benedict XVI as a theologian, but also as someone who devoted their life to the church. And that has been the sentiment among most of those who have wanted to be, as I say, among the first to pay their respects.
Yeah, so those are the people in the square. But are people, those who are more critical of his role in the church's cover-up of sexual abuse, are they talking today?
Well, certainly these debates have been had over recent days, perhaps not right where I am now in St. Peter's Square. But it's not just the fact that there was controversy because of his failure to act on over sex abuse allegations against many clergy around him, in where he apparently had opportunities to act, but also not putting in the systems in place to deal with such allegations when they were put forward in the future. But of course, there is this sense that Pope Benedict XVI also didn't have the sort of rock star status of the Pope that came before him, John Paul II, isn't seen to have the sort of personal touch of Pope Francis, who came after him as well. So these aren't the kind of scenes that we saw in 2005 after the death of John Paul II. But as I say, people are still at least coming forward to pay their respects to someone who devoted so much of their life to the church.
Aleem Makbul in the Vatican. Back in 2016, India's largely cash-based economy was thrown into chaos when the government suddenly withdrew more than 85% of the notes in circulation. Now, though, the country's Supreme Court has upheld the move, designed to target undeclared money, saying it did follow due process. Our South Asia regional editor, Anbarasan Etarajan, told me more about the impact the decision had had.
The Prime Minister Narendra Modi appeared on television and then said all these high-value denomination notes will be withdrawn. That gave only 4 hours' notice. And of course, people were having a lot of savings, people already in transaction business. They were all in shock because they had to convert this money into new money by depositing the entire cash into the banks. But much of this money were not accounted. People were not paying tax. So if they're going to go back to the banks to deposit the money, then the tax man will catch hold of them. And the Indian economy, almost 90%, it is cash dependent. If you go to any shop, if you buy anything, it was only cash transaction. So people were really suffering. Many people had to cancel their weddings. People like lost their jobs. And many people died while standing in queues to convert their money into the new currency. At the same time, the government supporters argued it was a very good move. And many opposition parties, they took the government to court to discuss whether the government had any legal point in announcing this, because it should have been announced by the central bank.
The aim was to get rid of black money. Did it succeed?
The government says that it has brought more people into the tax net. For example, India's population of 1.36 billion, only 4% pay income tax. By bringing more people into the tax net, the government argues that revenue will go up. That can be used for, you know, social projects and developmental projects. But on the other hand, the opposition parties would argue that, in fact, it ruined the economy, especially small and medium-scale industries. Many economists would argue that it did not achieve the purpose of abolishing the black money or unaccounted money, because people find other ways of keeping the cash.
Anbarasan Etirajan. To Mexico now, where an attack at a prison in the city of Ciudad Juarez has left 14 people dead, 10 prison guards and 4 inmates. More than 20 prisoners escaped after suspected drug cartel gunmen opened fire on the facility near the Mexico-US border. Our correspondent in Mexico is Will Grant.
Even by the violent standards of Mexican prisons, this was an audacious and brutal attack. The authorities in the state of Chihuahua report that several armoured vehicles arrived outside the state prison and gunmen got out and began firing on the guards. As well as those killed inside the jail, the majority of them prison guards, some 24 inmates managed to escape during the attack. The prison was also the site of an uprising last August, in which the riot inside the jail spilt over into the streets. 11 people were killed on that occasion. Both incidents go to underline the strength which the drug cartels still exert in the prison system in the border city of Ciudad Juarez. The state prosecutor's office has promised an investigation into this latest attack, and after the authorities regained control of the facility, police confiscated vehicles and 14 weapons in the immediate area. The escaped inmates, however, have not been apprehended.
Will Grant in Mexico. The French president has called on people in France to continue saving energy as Russia's invasion of Ukraine drags on. Emmanuel Macron has introduced a series of measures to try to cope with energy shortages, saying they were needed to prevent power cuts and high energy bills. So what impact are these measures having? John Laurenson has been to a supermarket near Paris to find out.
This is my local Carrefour. The French call supermarkets like this grande surface, large surface areas. And this one's so vast that some of the staff use roller skates to get about. It's not a bad idea to keep moving at the moment, because they've lowered the heating as well as the lighting, which is provoking different reactions from customers.
They're right to do this. Everyone has to do their bit. These big stores are setting a good example. And it's not so bad. You're always moving in the hypermarket, so that keeps you warm. As for the lights, perhaps you can't see things quite as clearly, but you can still see the prices.
On voit quand même les prix.
C'est glauque.
It's sinister.
Il fait un peu trop froid pour vous.
It's a little too cold for you.
Yes, it's unpleasant.
Are you tempted to shop elsewhere?
Yes. My son told me there is a hypermarket 25 minutes from here, where they have left the heating and lighting. But with the cost of petrol now, that's too far.
At the checkout, I ask the cashier, who's wrapped up so much she's round like a Christmas robin, if it's just me or if it's colder than usual. It is, she says. Are you cold? I ask her. My hands, she says. Above all, it's my hands.
Les mains, oui.
My thermometer says 14 or 15 degrees Celsius. If that's right, Carrefour is dropping temperatures even further than it and other supermarkets have pledged to do in what they call their sobriety protocol. Franck Charton is CEO of Perifem, the French Technical Retail Federation that looks after environmental, safety and energy matters for 70% of French supermarkets.
The first stage of the sobriety protocol is to change everyday action, for example, by dimming the lights or lowering the heating to 19 degrees Celsius, of course. If all the stores are doing that, that means 25,000 stores, we would achieve a total saving of about 1 million kilowatt hour. That's about 6% of the total consumption of the retail sector in France per year.
which is huge, by the way. 15 million megawatt hours a year, says Charton, the entire production of a medium-sized nuclear power station. Lowering consumption is also, of course, saving these stores a lot of money. They're not the only ones doing this, though. Other big users are making efforts too. Many schools are turning down the heating, as are many of this country's 36,000-odd town halls. Many municipalities are turning off street lighting early and ordering shopkeepers to switch off their window displays too. They're even turning off early the lights of the Eiffel Tower. At the checkout of another hypermarket, Leclerc, my thermometer once more reads 15 Celsius. Again, all right if you're moving, but a bit nippy otherwise. Not too cold, I ask the cashier.
Pas trop froid?
Yes, she replies, I am.
John Lawrenson with that report. A hospital in northern Ghana has got people talking by measuring one of its patients at 289 centimetres tall. That's about 9.5 feet. Suleimana Abdul Samad, who's 29, has been diagnosed with a rare condition known as gigantism. Our reporter, Favour Nunu, went to meet him and find out whether Suleimana is the tallest man in the world.
The local hospital did not have proper measuring equipment, and they improvised. They brought together a wooden stick, which they used to, as an extension. They kind of just guesstimated and then put him or pegged him at 9 feet, 6 inches. But even he was not quite sure whether that is the case or not. And so when we broached the subject of, can we come along and measure you to be sure what your height actually is, he was quite happy to allow us to do that. And that's what we did. And it turned out that he's actually 7 feet, 4 inches. However, he looks tall, even taller than the buildings within his neighborhood. And that gives the impression of how huge a giant he is.
Because it actually could be the case that in the future he is the world's tallest man. Still, he's still growing, isn't he?
Indeed, he is still growing. The world's tallest man alive is 8 feet, 2.8 inches. And he's 40 years as of December of 2022. Samad is only 29 years old. And so if you project that he lives to 40 and over, then obviously with someone who is growing after every 4 or 5 months by a few inches, it's almost clear that he could be the world's tallest man sometime in future.
And while that would have some sort of celebrity implications for him, which it could be worth some money, it's not something he would welcome, is it? It's actually something of a curse.
He's quite expecting to live a very full life. But first, he hopes that he can deal with medical complications that he's been having recently as a result of the growth spurt. And once that is done with, he's only looking forward to living and enjoying life and enjoying his local celebrity status, which is already quite exciting in Gambaga, the village where he lives here in Ghana.
BBC reporter Favour Nunu in northern Ghana. And that's all for this edition of the Global News Podcast. But before we go, a thought from one of our listeners, Cliff Keane, who emailed to say thanks for the Happy News podcast over Christmas. I always feel that the news is too slanted towards disasters and unfortunate events, he wrote, and that this does not give a realistic view of how the world is. Cliff suggested that we could do a weekly Happy News to give more balance. We'll give that some thought. But in the meantime, let us know what you think. Are we doing too much bad news, or are we getting the mix about right? Our email address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by David Evans, and the producer was Terry Egan. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.